It's 9:30 here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. The Green Valley News for Wednesday, August 12th. Mark DeGroft with you. A 67-year-old Green Valley man was so convinced by scammers he was going to double his investment, he was so convinced that he took out a personal loan, refinanced his home, and dipped into his retirement account. According to a Pima County Sheriff's Department report, the man not only lost $300,000, but his wife left him as well. The man walked into Green Valley Substation on July 13th to report falling victim to two scams. The first started in August of 2025. The man told deputies that he had received a text from an unknown person who had said that they texted the wrong number, but then pitched a Bitcoin and gold trading investment. According to the report, the texter told the man her stepfather was the CEO of Vicar Holdings in China. She then added him to a group text with people he was told were leaders of the company. He was convinced to purchase Bitcoin, convert it to gold, and invest it into a trading group, the report stated. He was shown an investment platform that resembled a Charles Schwab investment interface. And from August 25th through June of 2026, the man told authorities he made 4 to 5 wire transfers. He also deposited money into Bitcoin machines, including one at a shady-looking market in South Tucson. He stated he attempted to reach a total investment of $300,000, believing he would receive a return of $550,000 to $600,000. His wife told him in November of 2025 that he was being scammed, but he kept investing secretly, although he did have to obtain her signature when he refinanced their home, according to the report. In addition to getting a personal loan and refinancing his home, the victim told deputies that he withdrew $157,000 from his retirement account, incurring penalties and taxes. In late June, the man told deputies he received a call from a man with an Indian accent who said his name was Mike Jones and he works as a Wells Fargo fraud analyst, the report stated. Jones told him his accounts were compromised and instructed him to transfer all of the funds into a separate account to protect them. The man said he made 3 transfers totaling more than $136,000, and when the wire transfer started to fail, he withdrew $10,000 at Jones's request so they could be deposited into a Bitcoin ATM. He deposited $2,000, the daily limit, and then returned the rest to the bank. Between the two scams, the victim estimated losing about $300,000. A deputy wrote in his report, the victim appeared distressed and stated, "Here I am, 67 years old and broke. My wife's gone. Can't trust me no more." The sheriff's department advised the man to block all of the suspect's numbers and to file a report with the Federal Trade Commission and other federal agencies, and the case was then closed. Cryptocurrency is digital money that is completely unregulated. It allows people to make payments directly to each other through an online system, but it does not require a bank or financial institution to verify those transactions. Among the best-known cryptocurrencies are Bitcoin, Dogecoin, Solana, Ethereum, and Binance Coin. However, it's not government-regulated, and so authorities say it's highly attractive to con artists, drug cartels, illegal arms dealers, child pornographers, and others. Once the money is lost, there's no way of tracking it or getting it back. Last September, the cryptocurrency kiosk license fraud prevention law went into effect. It means more warnings will be placed on cryptocurrency machines, and they'll start requiring transaction receipts. The law also limits daily transactions to $2,000 a day for new customers and $10,500 a day for existing customers. And while we're on the topic of scams, fraud fighter Brian Wilson writes this, "I've been watching the television show The Simpsons since I was in college. I love the irreverent humor and the writer's ability to poke fun at everyone and everything. In season 33, a phone scammer convinces Grandma Simpson that his grandson Bart is in jail and needs $10,000 wired to the authorities," in quotes. In the episode, Grandpa's son Homer says everything you should never say to scam victim, including, "I would have never fallen for that. Everyone knows about that scam, and what were you thinking?" This episode made its point of trying to find some humor in a really awful crime. It got me thinking. The words we choose really do matter. It's not about being politically correct. It's about focusing the blame on the criminal and not the victim. Far too often, the blame for financial fraud is directed at the victims rather than the criminals. We say things like, he fell for a romance scam, when in reality a criminal targeted, manipulated, and exploited this person. Or we say she lost money in a tech support scam, when the money was stolen, not lost, or willingly given away. I've been guilty of using this language. On many occasions I have said someone fell for a scam. Today, I am much more intentional with the words that I choose. For example, we have covered the term pig butchering many times in this column. A more appropriate term is now being used is cryptocurrency investment fraud. Some of my fellow fraud fighters suggest we go even so far as to not use the term scammer because it does not seem as bad as calling someone a criminal. Others have stated using the term romance fraud instead of romance scam. AARP initiated a Words Matter campaign to change the societal narrative around financial fraud by eliminating victim-blaming language. The movement urges the public, the media, and law enforcement to focus blame on criminals rather than on the victims. The goal of the campaign is to encourage reporting. If we inadvertently blame victims, it keeps them from speaking up and enables the crimes to continue. Changing the narrative empowers victims to contact the authorities and then seek support. So here are some other examples of improved wording. Instead of saying, how much money did you give them, we can say, how much did the criminal steal? Instead of saying, scammers are so clever they tricked you, we can say, a criminal stole your money through a web of lies and deceit. And instead of saying, how could you fall for that, or didn't you see the warning flags, we can say, this isn't your fault, you experience a crime. When I write future versions of this column, I'll make sure that the focus is on the actions of the criminals and not on the victims. Well, if you like looking up at the sky in the evening, Wednesday night could bring one of the best meteor showers of the year to the southern Arizona skies as a new moon makes for prime viewing. Or a forecast of clouds and showers can ruin observing the peak. The Perseid meteor shower will hit its peak on Wednesday night, going into Thursday morning, with NASA reporting 50 to 100 meteors per hour possible during the ideal conditions. But that might not be the case in Green Valley and much of southern Arizona amid an active monsoon. The National Weather Service in Tucson expects cloudy skies and a 70% chance of rain. Weather Service Tucson reported showers and possible thunderstorms were likely after 11 o'clock p.m. on Wednesday. The forecast comes at the same time that the Perseid showers peak during a new moon, which will have 0% of its surface illuminated. The Perseids began on July 17th, and there is still some hope for southern Arizona residents to catch the shower before it ends on August 24th. The American Meteor Society estimates observers could see 30 to 50 meteors per hour at maximum for normal hourly rates in the most rural areas. The bad news is that the moon will be waxing gibbous phase by August 24th, with 84% of its surface illuminated, that putting enough of light in the sky to reduce visibility. Weather Service Tucson expects partly cloudy to cloudy nights and chances for rain every night through Saturday when the moon will be at 8% illuminated. There's a virtual plan B for southern Arizona residents if the weather doesn't cooperate. NASA plans to have a live stream watch party on YouTube. That'll be starting at 9 o'clock p.m. on Wednesday. NASA is setting up cameras at the Marshall Space Flight Center's Automated Lunar and Meteor Observatory in Huntsville, Alabama. They will also take questions, talk with meteor experts, and share sky views from the International Space Station throughout the night. The Perseid showers come from particles released from the comet 109P Swift-Tuttle during its past strolls through the inner solar system. Observers see the showers as the Earth passes through Swift-Tuttle's debris cloud, which interacts with the atmosphere and creates colorful streaks as the bits disintegrate in the night sky. Swift Tuttle was discovered in 1862, but observers didn't connect it as the Perseid shower source until 1865. NASA reported Perseid observations date to more than 2,000 years ago. The comet takes 133 years to orbit the Sun just once, and the last time Swift Tuttle made its closest approach was in 1992. The next time it reaches perihelion will be in 2125. NASA reported Swift Tuttle has a 16-mile-wide nucleus, adding that it's twice the size of the object thought by some scientists to have killed the dinosaurs. If you want to have more information, you can go to bit.ly/3UQS7IH or just join the watch party on YouTube. And good luck. A 2008 job opening in Qualcomm Stadium's executive suites launched Jerry and Roxanne Brooks into a world of NFL royalty, star athletes, and Hollywood celebrities. "Our time there was great fun, good exercise, and we had the best view in the house," Jerry said. According to Brooks, Dallas Cowboys owner Jerry Jones is what you would expect from television. New England Patriots owner Robert Kraft is a man of big entrances. Iconic former Raiders owner Al Davis is legendary. And as for Davis's son and current Raiders coach owner Mark Davis, he's a total drip. I mean, a total waste of time, Brooks said. Brooks said NFL icons Dan Marino, John Elway, and Jim Plunkett, along with big-name celebrities Adam Sandler and Ray Romano, are great guys and funny. And Raider fans, they're the worst. They were rowdy, and they were boisterous, and they were demanding. And they drank so heavily, Brooks said. Before moving to Green Valley in 2019, the married couple lived in Southern California, where Jerry Brooks served as vice president of marketing for an industrial software company called Wonderware until about 1995. Their chance to work guest services in the Qualcomm Stadium executive suites arose years later when their daughter was attending the University of San Diego. Through a contract on the university's parent advisory board with ties to the NFL franchise, Jerry and Roxanne secured the game day roles. Work for a typical 1 p.m. kickoff began with an 8 a.m. staff briefing. Duties included preparing the suites, handling public relations, and logging plenty of steps. By 6 o'clock p.m., the couple were usually back home in Murrieta. Among the notable figures Brooks served were Sophie Vergara of Modern Family fame, Everybody Loves Raymond star Ray Romano, and actor Adam Sandler. When the New York Jets visited, Brooks overheard Romano, a long-suffering Jets fan, updating a friend over the phone in his signature deadpan delivery. He says, "I mean, you want to get here, it's 0-0, we're winning." And then he says, "Oh yeah, I forget it, they're already losing 6-0. Brooks recalled. He also remembered Sandler and a group of friends running up and down the causeway with backward hats, creating a playful ruckus. Brooks had to fight back laughter when ushering them to their seats. "It looks like it was like they were showing off, obviously, or they were just having a great time," Brooks said. The couple had high praise for the family of longtime Chargers starting quarterback Philip Rivers, describing him as polite and down-to-earth. "They were the nicest people, the kindest people," Roxanne said. "They didn't pray to win. They prayed that everybody would be safe on the field and that nobody would get injured and that everybody would have a good game." Brooks recalled an amusing moment when the Rivers family, who are devout Catholics, brought their bishop to the suite. "So the bishop is coming in and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, I'm going to have to act really right. And he looks to me and says, 'Did they get the wine that I ordered? I thought it was going to be 'Bless you, my son.' But no, it was 'Did you get the wine that I ordered?'" Brooks said with a laugh. Roxanne also hosted several elite athletes, including former San Diego quarterback and Pro Football Hall of Fame class of 2026 inductee Drew Brees. But hosting NBA legend Michael Jordan was her personal highlight. Jordan, who was dating the dance coordinator for the Miami Dolphins at the time, offered to take a photo with Roxanne after she worked up the nerve to break protocol and ask if he would meet a stadium worker who was a diehard fan. "I said, 'It's taking me an hour to come here and even ask you,'" she recalled. He goes, "Oh, sure, I'll meet him." she didn't pass up Jordan's subsequent offer for a photo of her own. Not every pregame moment was lighthearted. Before a 2009 Monday Night Football game, the loud crashing noise of a fatal accident startled workers when a game day volunteer fell about 30 feet from a booth for assistant coaches into the seating bowl. It caused quite a stir. It was at least 2 hours before game time, so they had enough time to literally clean it up, Brooks said. When it came to unruly visiting fan bases, Jerry Brooks said the Oakland Raider fans were by far the rowdiest. Alcohol-infused fights were routine. Tailgate arrests frequently spilled into the stadium after kickoff. The hostility eventually prompted a policy change, cutting off beer sales after halftime rather than the late third quarter when Oakland was in town. Jerry grew accustomed to the physical altercations, but the foul language around children was disheartening. He recalled having to relocate Maria Shriver and her children, who were seated directly above a section of raucous fans. The drunken atmosphere eventually led Roxanne to step down just a few years before her husband. She noted that Raiders fan behavior had visibly deteriorated since the glory days of the John Madden coach team from the late 1970s that she grew up watching. The only reason why I moved on, I just got tired of the drunk people and the Raider fans were the worst, she said. Despite the chaotic fan base, Jerry held a soft spot for Raiders franchise and the late Al Davis. He fondly remembered telling Davis he used to be a fan. "What do you mean you used to be a Raiders fan? You're always a Raiders fan," Brooks recalls Davis telling him. He also recalled Patriots owner Robert Kraft making grand entrances in a golf cart, waving to crowds while his granddaughter Jessica quietly waited in the suite, preferring to avoid the spotlight. "He's driving in the stadium on a golf cart. It's like the Pope was around," Brooks said. The Chargers announced their relocation to Los Angeles shortly after the 2016 season, ending a 56-year run for the franchise in San Diego and drawing a curtain on Brooks's role in the executive suites at Qualcomm Stadium. And during his 9 seasons in the Skybox, Brooks was fortunate to work games among two NFL matriarchs, the late Virginia Halas Maskowski, former owner of the Chicago Bears and daughter of NFL co-founder George Halas, and Martha Firestone Ford, former principal owner of the Detroit Lions and the granddaughter of Harvey Firestone. Firestone Ford is the widow of William C. Ford, a grandson of Ford Motor Company founder Henry Ford. An exchange with Firestone Ford remains one of Brooks's favorite memories. "I jokingly told her my favorite car growing up was a 1967 Ford Mustang, but it had Goodyears on it, and she laughed like crazy," Brooks said. She said her tires were Firestones, but her car was a Caddy convertible. The Suarita Town Council saw a packed house on Monday night as more than 25 people spent nearly 90 minutes making comments during the call to the public, focusing primarily on one topic, data centers. All 23 speakers who spoke solely about data centers opposed them, and a speaker from Save the Scenic Santa Rita's also added her opposition to data centers as she closed out comments opposing Hudbay Minerals Copper World Mine progress. Several speakers clad in Stop Copper World shirts also spent 3 minutes before the council focused on their opposition to data centers. The long call to the audience comes amid growing concern among Sorita and Green Valley residents over a possible data center development on a 200-acre property on La Cañada Drive and Sorita Road just south of Rancho Resort. In July of 2025, Rancho Sorita managing partner Jeremy Sharp asked the town for formal confirmation that a data center was a permitted use for the property per the Rancho Sorita specific plan zoning. Community Development Director Anna Cassidy provided formal confirmation to Rancho Suarita the following month. The Reverend Randy Mayer from Good Shepherd United Church of Christ was among those opposing the data center. He said it was interesting that the Tucson City Council could recently approve restricting zoning regulations for data centers as a much older city, while Suarita Town Development staff says their hands are tied. I don't know if the council agrees with that, Mayor said. Tucson City Council and Pima County Board of Supervisors are recognizing that projects of this scale require stronger safeguards for surrounding neighborhoods and other areas, and they're willing to step up. He said the town should look at adding safeguards requiring a sizable distance from any neighborhoods. The potential site on La Quinada and Suarita Road sits directly across the street from Rancho Resort, he said. The church held a data center forum in June that drew about 200 people. Speakers on Monday asked the council to explore more restrictive regulations, increase transparency and non-disclosure information, and some also pushed for an outright data center ban. Council member Stephen Gillespie asked staff if the town had received any plans for data center near the tail end of the speakers. State open meeting laws place tight restrictions on how much discussion a governing body can hold or respond to calls to the public, given they typically contain items that are not publicly advertised on an agenda prior to the meeting. Town manager Shane Dill said the town hasn't received anything. Gillespie also asked if the council would be discussing zoning that includes data centers at a later time. You would have a conversation as a council with staff and the hired consultant to help us with the zoning code amendment dealing with data centers. It would be in industrial zone properties and outside of specific planned areas, Dill said. And he added that it wouldn't affect the Rancho Suarita specific plan that the town council adopted back in 1996. The town reported it started work on the industrial zone amendment and plans to schedule a public meeting to gather feedback in the fall. I also state just to anticipate that you'll ask this question. No, we have not been asked to sign any kind of non-disclosure agreements in the 4 years that I have been with the town, and I don't see any on the horizon, Dill told the council. Vice Mayor Kara Egbert asked the town staff if the public should direct their concern at the council or Rancho Suarita management following the call to the public, given the 200-acre property at the center of it all is Rancho Suarita's and they have control of that property. Dill told the council that when a developer has zoned property with confirmed use, it's not the planned use that goes before the council when an application is filed. The council, with Rancho Suarita's development, can't say you can't put industrial use on that property because it's already zoned industrial use, he said. Dill said the council would be instead be counseling if asking if it could be served by their property's utility and emergency service providers and what that service would look like. He said it would be a matter of the council shifting from questioning the property's use to whether that use can even happen. That decision has come and gone, Dill said, regarding whether a heavy industrial user could be on the property. Throughout the United States, prosecutors and judges often come under fire following the resolution of felony cases. We asked Pima County Attorney Laura Conover to answer some of our questions about the handling of high-level cases, the public's expectations, and the reality of the job. Conover, who's a Democrat, was elected in 2020 and then re-elected in 2024, both by wide margins. Question: it would be cost prohibitive for every felony case to be taken to trial. Can you provide us with other reasons why cases end up being resolved through plea agreements? Indeed, it would also be humanly and systematically impossible. A plea agreement is a negotiation that frankly favors the prosecutor. When a defendant decides to accept responsibility, take account for their actions, accept a felony conviction on their record, and avow to make financial restitution, this is a win for the government and for the community. A trial is a right the defendant can and should use when they are not guilty of the accusations against them or when the case has been exaggerated. And when a defendant instead agrees to plead guilty, the prosecutor's office has won. Full stop. The exorbitant cost to the courts, the re-traumatizing of the victim, the cost to the taxpayer are all instead resolved by the defendant publicly confessing in court. Again, a plea agreement is a win. No one has ever argued otherwise anywhere in the country until recently on social media due to a lack of understanding or willful ignorance of how the system works. Question: how much influence does a victim have when it comes to the resolution of their case? The Arizona Victims' Bill of Rights is one of the most powerful in the country, and we more than respect that. Our Victim Services Division, which marked 50 years last year, was a pioneer and remains somewhat of an outlier in our attempt to meet a victim in real time during their crisis, seeing them through to the end of their case. Also, Arizona law is very clear that our prosecutors represent community safety. To be very clear, under the law, our prosecutors are absolutely not the attorney for the victim. The victim's voice is critical, and the law requires the prosecutor to move forward with charges and with their own strategy, with safety as their ultimate goal. As an example, our data indicates that over 50% of our felony domestic violence jury trials require our prosecutors to go forward, even if we have lost the help of the victim. And in fact, often the victim is actually seated with the defense attorney and the defendant assisting them against us. One can imagine those prosecutors have my utmost respect. Importantly, I made a promise when I arrived in office in 2021 that I would meet personally with any family that had lost a loved one in a criminal justice-related event. Due to the homicide backlog we inherited, I'm sad to say I've had more than 100 such meetings. Sitting, listening, receiving their information has been one of the most profoundly difficult, informative, and rewarding experiences of my time in this office thus far. I think it's important to stress to the community that we are working every single day to help keep everyone safe and healthy. We know that it's a complicated and a long process that will take time and resources, but it is a work in progress. National data shows it. It's clear that crime numbers are down, and regardless of that, we're continuing to collaborate with our local law enforcement partners and will utilize innovative practices to create a community that our children will be proud to raise their families in and call their home. The Green Valley News for Wednesday, Mark DeGroft with you. Wishing you a very pleasant afternoon. Wallace Kleindienst will be here on Friday. I'm back on Monday. Until then, stay cool and take care.